Jacksonville Institution sends out a call to action. Good morning and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect, and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, the emergency appeal to keep Clara White mission afloat. And your calls. Give us a call now. It's 549-2937. Then later, are we packaging away our planet? A new report ranks the nation's grocery chains on their efforts to eliminate those single-use plastics. We'll find out how our local chains fared. Plus, Al Letson is back in town. We'll hear about his performance this weekend at the Five and Dime Theater. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, it is a critical time for one of the city's most vital institutions. Downtown Jacksonville's Clara White Mission made an emergency call to action funding appeal last week. It's needed to avoid drastic service cuts at the mission. Jacksonville City Councilwoman Jacoby Pittman runs the Clara White Mission, and she's on the line now with more. Councilwoman Pittman, thanks for being with us.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks for being
here. As the CEO of the Clara White Mission today.
That's right. And give us a call right now as we talk about Clara White at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org and tweets to @MelissaInJax. Can you begin by explaining why is Clara White Mission sending out this emergency appeal?
Well, Melissa, first of all, it's very devastating. This is a time of year that we hear back from some of our funders what our upcoming year funding would be. And unfortunately, all of them from a governmental standpoint, we're still receiving, but at a reduced rate. And unfortunately, it's very hard for a nonprofit to make up that kind of money in a short period of time. And so as a board of directors and myself, we discuss what would be our plan because our year funding starts at July 1. And so we found out a few weeks before that. And so unfortunately, we're trying to see how we could make up the funds. And, you know, the community has always been generous, and we reached out with an appeal to ask for help. And, you know, the Clara White Mission is not the only one that, you know, having issue with reduced funding, you know, from governmental support. And so this has really put us in a devastating position where we've gone from 7 days a week to 5 days a week. In addition to trying to help ourselves with the entrepreneurial initiatives that we have. But as I said, it's hard to make that kind of money up within a short period of time.
It's 549-2937 as we talk about the vital importance of the Clara White Mission to this city. Now, as you said, you lost money from an expected federal grant. It was reduced from $800,000 to a fraction of that, $300,000. Why did the feds reduce this contribution?
Well, I think just, you know, over the years and just the time, not only, you know, it's the combination of, you know, local, state, and federal funding that's being cut. And so it just comes all at one time. Mainly for our vocational training program and our feeding program to the community. And, you know, we have been able to provide these vital services for over 115 years. And so we want to make sure that we continue those programs because individuals who are homeless, veterans, low income, depend on our services.
That's right. You serve at the Downtown Clara White Mission over 125,000 meals a year. But you now only have funding for about half of that expected cost. We're talking about kids, families, senior citizens. These are food insecure people, sometimes homeless, but not always. Can you tell us a little bit more about everything Clara White Mission does and why it's such a vital part of the nonprofit space in Jacksonville?
Absolutely. Well, one is that, you know, our founder, Earthling Clara White Mission, funded this and started this over 115 years ago. And poor people have been with us since the beginning of time, and they'll be with us to the end of time. But we have been able to expand based on the need of the individuals that come to the Clara White Mission every day. So not only do we provide them a nutritious meal, but a lot of them are looking for an opportunity to stabilize and get their life back. So we're able to provide, you know, training programs in culinary art, janitorial, and environmental services, which is a national certified program. And we're also licensed by the Department of Education. So our students, when they graduate, they can work anywhere in the United States. In addition, we provide housing not only for homeless veterans, but individuals who are living on the streets. And we provide those housing. So it is a comprehensive program. So you may come through our feeding line and you're ready to get your life together. And then you can enroll into our housing program as well as our training. So we have had about 1,500 people that have enrolled in our program, and about 65% of those are still in the workforce. And to allow our culinary students to have the hands-on training, we have a partnership with St. John's Episcopal Church, where we have a cafe on Fridays where the patrons can come and patronize our cafe and allow our students to have that hands-on training. And so with all of the moving parts that we have, we feel that we are an asset to the vulnerable individuals that we serve on a daily basis, and we want to continue to be an asset and a cornerstone in the community. And the only way that we can do that at this point right now is to get the support from the community. We also have a farm, which is on the north side of town. It's 14 acres, where we grow food for individuals that live in food desert communities. And the access of that is also that we serve the homeless downtown at our site at the Clara White Mission.
Right. White Harvest Farms, which you also run, working to address the issue of food deserts. So many aspects to Clara White. And as you mentioned just briefly, Clara's at the cathedral on Fridays at lunch is a, you know, a downtown institution. I love going to grab lunch on Fridays there, although I can't do it as often as I used to due to my work schedule. It's just it's just one way that you can support the Clara White Mission and have a great meal. You'll always see people you know. It's only $10, right, and you are helping people get good jobs and have a future, and you're supporting the work of Clara White. Now, let me ask you, because the community has stepped up pretty generously. You've gotten gifts from the Padgick and Padgick Law Firm, the poker company Best Bet, Cisco, other companies, anonymous donors. It's my understanding that you yourself have taken a temporary pay cut to get Clara White through this crisis. And so everybody is doing what they can, but it, you still need a little more help. You're not out of the woods yet. Is that right?
Right. I'm still in the ditch trying to get out.
Right.
But yes, I have taken a 20% cut as of right now. Our board of directors have stepped up. 100% of our board of directors have given to this challenge as well. And the Jaguars have, you know, always supported the Clara White Mission in our efforts. And they wanted to provide a lead gift because they believe in what we do. And it's an asset to our community. And, you know, just this week we had Pageant and Pageant. They matched the gift of the Jags. And Best Bet has always been a partner with us in the community as well. So, you know, if not cash, we have one of our nonprofits, Feeding North East Florida, who has agreed to deliver, you know, breakfast food for us through this through this time. And so, you know, the community has really, really stepped up, as well as on social media. We received about $10,000 from individuals, you know, on Facebook and on our website who believe in what we're doing. And I'm just so excited that the community has stepped up. Yes, we have about $210,000 to go by August 30th. And I am just a believer that we will make that so we can continue to provide the services that are essential to the less fortunate in our community.
All right, let's go to some calls now for Jacoby Pittman, president and CEO of the Claire White Mission, also on the Jacksonville City Council. We'll talk about that in a little bit, but first let's get to your calls. 549-2937. Susan is in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. Good morning. Oh, we lost the call.
Yes. No, but here's no, I'm here.
Oh, go ahead, Susan.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
I don't know why that sound is there.
I don't know.
You want me to keep talking?
Yeah. Go ahead. Ask your question quickly.
Okay. So what I'm about to say, I hope it doesn't negate the fact that from what I'm hearing, the Claire White Mission does fabulous work. And I do hope people will contribute because it really does sound awesome. But I also wonder now that Ms. Pittman is part of the City Council, how she will be voting for what I call corporate welfare. So it's great that the Jaguars owner is contributing to Claire White Mission, but he's also asking the taxpayers to give him some, I guess, corporate welfare, as I will call it, because I read in a recent Times Union article that he's asking for certain incentives. So I don't know what they are.
And yeah.
Another troubling thing is, like, as we're going through the school board referendum, it seems like some people, and I think Dr. Green is resisting it, but some people want to use our sales tax money to buy privately owned buildings. And I just wonder about this movement to use our taxpayer money to enrich people rather than to help people in need. Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Councilwoman Pittman, let's put on your city council hat for a minute. You will be, you've already been asked this question a lot, where you stand on not just incentives for the Jaguars and their Lot J development around the stadium, but also the proposed half-cent sales tax referendum for Duval County Public Schools. What would you say to constituents out there who feel that the city's priorities are misplaced in terms of where our tax dollars are going?
Well, I think in terms of she's asking about the school board, I definitely support efforts in providing renovations for the school board. I think we're at a point now that we're voting or will be voting is November the time to put it on the ballot, or we put it on next year's ballot. It's important that we receive all the information that is needed to address that issue and vote on, you know, to make sure there's a scope of services of what schools need to be first and the cost of those, you know, of those schools as well. But I think it's important that we get the input, you know, as well from the community, and we, you know, we vote from there. But I am confident with the experience and with the new council coming in as my colleagues that, you know, the right decision will be made to ensure that the schools will be taken care of in the upcoming year.
Do you plan to vote for this referendum to be placed on the ballot next year in November of 2020?
Well, right now there's some more information, you know, that is needed, and I will make my decision at that time.
Okay, so what would that information be since the district has put together a really comprehensive plan already?
Well, they put a comprehensive, you know, plan together, but there's still just the scope of work that need to be done in terms of, you know, which school the first, the financial piece, you know, will it be in phases, and how would that look within the next year or so? Because I just want to make sure that we don't you know, run into problems like Manatee County has had over the last few months in terms of a plan of when and when it will be instituted.
And let me ask you, looking at this from a bigger picture, going beyond Duval County Public Schools, as the CEO of a vital downtown nonprofit, you're well-versed in how the nonprofit world is funded, how the most vulnerable populations in this city are supported or not. What would you say to the narrative that's formed around not just the school issue, but so many other issues that Jacksonville just refuses to invest in itself, whether it's when you talk about education, when you talk about the nonprofit community, when you talk about infrastructure, that this city is underfunded across the board? And as a public official now, you're in a unique position because you have oversight over the budget, but you're also trying to get the appropriate funds for Clara White mission. So I'm just curious to get your perspective on that criticism of this city's leadership and how it apportions money.
Well, you know, I am just one of 19 votes. I hope that my perspective of working in the nonprofit will bring a fresh perspective and in terms of what's needed for the nonprofits as well. We have a couple other members who have nonprofit experience as well. I think, you know, hopefully in the upcoming budget, that there will be opportunities to maybe increase in areas that is needed in terms of funding for our community, for not only just the nonprofits, but to allocate funding to areas that we've discussed for several years that need the support. And so, you know, over the next few months with the budget, we'll be discussing that in terms of, you know, what we need to prepare for and to make sure that those needs and those gaps of services will be met in the upcoming year.
All right. And let's go to some more calls now for Jacoby Pittman, CEO of the Clara White Mission. Conrad is on the north side. Hi, Conrad. Good morning. Go ahead, Conrad.
Conrad Markle, concerned taxpayers of Duval County. I've just been concerned, really concerned, since this first article about Clara White turned up last week. I haven't had a chance to go over the proposed budget for this year, but there used to always be a floating stipend from the city for all of our recognized top-tier nonprofits in particular. Did I miss something? Has the Curry administration completely cut donations to all of these organizations?
Thanks for that question. Jacoby, Councilwoman.
Yes.
Has there been a local cut to funds for Clara White and other like-minded nonprofits?
Yes, there has. Over the years, at least within the last 3 years or so, all nonprofits have been cut that were supported by the city of Jacksonville. And that was prior to me coming on to the council. But what I can say is that the city of Jacksonville nonprofits have come together when there was an issue in the community. And so,
It sounds like someone's phone is going off in the background.
I can't hear. Hello?
Yeah, we're still here.
Okay. So within that time, like the Salzbacher Center, the City Rescue Mission, Trinity Mission, we all came together when those cuts occurred. And at that time, the Clara White Mission agreed to serve breakfast to the homeless and Salvation Army, and the Salzbacher Center served lunch and dinner. And so, you know, we just came together because we realized that the funds had been cut and there was no money. And we all just kind of stepped up to the plate in order to meet those needs for the homeless as well as veterans in our community. So, you know, and going forward, you know, with Clara White Mission being cut, it would be devastating to the other nonprofits because they have a budget as well. And, you know, we want to make sure that we don't put, you know, the needs, additional needs to them because they have a budget as well.
You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about this because you certainly have a long history in the nonprofit space and you understand what's at stake. If you aren't able to make up this funding cut, what will you be faced with?
Well, we would be faced with laying off staff and reducing our services to 3 days a week. And we really don't want to reduce the quality of our services that the homeless depend on so much. You know, some of them, you know, work in labor pools and don't have money. So they usually come to the Clara White Mission, have their breakfast, and they go to work. We have senior citizens who live in close proximity as well, who's on a fixed income, and they look to come to the Clara White Mission as well. We serve students who are enrolled in our training program, breakfast as well. So it is, we meet a comprehensive need in the community, and we want to continue to do that because we realize we also have a model, Melissa, that works. And as any nonprofit will tell you, you know, we know what it takes to run an organization, and we can apply for local, state, and federal funds, but we don't know actually what we're going to get because, as you mentioned earlier, funds are cut not just at the local level, but it impacts. And we're able to utilize those fundings from the different entities to leverage additional funding from public and private entities to run our organizations.
Okay, so with all of that said, as we mentioned a few moments ago, a number of companies and individuals have stepped up to help Clara White Mission, but you're putting out the call for this community to continue to close the gap. How can people support Clara White?
Well, they can call Clara White Mission at 904-354-4162, extension 1100, or they can mail their contribution to Clara White Mission, 613 West Ashley Street, Jacksonville, Florida, 32202, or they can go to our website at www.theclarawhitemission.org, as well as we're on Facebook as the Clara White Mission.
Jacoby Pittman, she's president and CEO of the Clara White Mission, also sits on the Jacksonville City Council. Thanks so much for joining us and spreading the word this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you so much, Melissa, for sharing with our community our challenge at Clara White Mission.
Happy to do it. And much more still ahead on the show later in the hour. Don't miss it as Al Letson, back in town for a special performance, tells us about his new one-man show and how you can see it this weekend. But up next, how our grocery store chains are contributing to the plastic pollution crisis. A new report after this. Well, it's a new report that ranks the nation's largest grocery chains on their efforts to eliminate single-use plastics. Yeah, when you visit your neighborhood grocery store, Publix, Winn-Dixie, wherever you go, many of the items that you buy, take home, and then discard contain plastic. And that plastic eventually ends up in landfills or in the ocean. And it turns out that across the board, while supermarkets are failing to address the plastic pollution crisis that they are a major contributor to. This is all in a new report from Greenpeace. It's called Packaging the Planet. And are you wondering where our local chains like Publix and Winn-Dixie might rank? Well, we were too. So we're pleased to welcome David Pinsky. He co-authored the Packaging the Planet report. He's also a Greenpeace Oceans campaigner, and he's on the line. Hey, David, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
And if you have questions about grocery store plastics pollution, we want your calls. It's 549-2937. Okay, so how much do grocery chains overall contribute to the plastic pollution crisis around the world, David?
They have a huge contribution. I don't have specific figures. One reason why, Melissa, is because grocery retailers are so lacking in transparency. So they're not actually telling the public the size of their plastic footprints. But we know if you look at Walmart, it's the world's largest retailer, the largest in the U.S. Here in the U.S., Publix is the seventh largest by revenue. These companies are producing massive amounts of single-use plastics to package their products. If you go into a Publix, you see oranges still in the orange peel on a black plastic tray and then shrink-wrapped in plastic. So there's a huge amount of plastics in supermarkets' operations, and actually the equivalent of one truckload full of plastic enters our oceans of every minute of every single day, year after year. So we know this is a huge problem, and we need to see market action.
You're really trying to put the pressure on supermarkets to get them to decrease their plastics use, and I'm curious about the rankings. Where do supermarkets in this part of the country rank when it comes to use of plastics, like Publix, Winn-Dixie, Harvey's, and other groceries that we have in our area?
So Publix actually came in last when we look at retailers operating in Florida. So it was ranked 15. Winn-Dixie and Harvey's, which are operated by Southeastern Grocers here in Jacksonville, came in at 14th. And Aldi was actually number one in the rankings, although it's important to note, Melissa, that every single one of these retailers failed to achieve a passing score, so that indicates how much work is needed.
Okay, and when you say a passing score, what would give a grocery store chain a passing score?
So we look at four key criteria in this evaluation, again called Packaging Away the Planet. We looked at their policies, their plastic reduction efforts, initiatives and innovation, and transparency. And so we take all that information into consideration through a detailed survey, as well as publicly available information, such as what's in stores or what's on their websites. And we have a pretty low bar for passing. It's actually 40 points out of 100, and Aldi came the closest at 34.6.
And Aldi scored the highest because they have a plastic reduction target, a real plan to use less plastics. Is that right?
Exactly. And so there's only a few retailers right now that have those public-facing plastic reduction targets. Aldi only has 15% is what it's looking to reduce its plastic footprint by 2025, but it's a start, and it's moving in the right direction. If we look at Publix, for example, it's largely only focused on recycling, and only 9% of all plastics ever created have been recycled. So we know that recycling alone is not going to solve this problem. Mm-hmm. We were heartened to see that Southeastern Grocers, which again operates Winn-Dixie and Harvey's, is starting to look into this issue, and I think there'll be some exciting developments in the future. Southeastern Grocers is also much more transparent than Publix in the survey process.
And how so? What have they told you?
Well, Some will have to wait and see, but Southeastern Grocers is certainly, I think this is an issue that throughout its leadership and multiple teams within the company, they're starting to actively look at some solutions and understand that recycling is not the only way to tackle this issue. There actually needs to be movement in reducing the amount of plastics produced in the first place. And so that's a huge encouragement that we have for all retailers, including Publix, Target, Walmart, Aldi, to really reduce that amount of plastic that's created in the first place, and look at reuse and refill delivery systems. So there used to be a time, Melissa, where folks didn't need to have oranges or potato chips come in plastic bags. So how do we move back to more of that reuse and refill society that we had years ago?
Right. Changing culture, changing mindset. And if you're just tuning in, as we talk with David Pinsky about this new Greenpeace report, Packaging Away the Planet, what are your questions about plastics at the grocery store? This is where millions of Americans generate the most plastic waste, because we all have to go and buy groceries, and there's so much unnecessary plastic at your neighborhood store. And there are so many examples of this. For my own part, I don't use plastic bags anymore when I go to the store. I use cloth bags. That's just one small way I can try to reduce my own plastic pollution. But the plastic bags are just one example of how groceries put everything under a plastic layer. Although, as you said, they're starting to try to find ways to eliminate unnecessary plastic packaging. Trader Joe's is one example of a chain we have in our area, you report, that's doing that. How can groceries present the food in a way that's still sanitary and still attractive to the consumer, but doesn't have so much plastic?
Well, one initiative, so it's great that you mentioned Trader Joe's. That was actually a campaign that was led by Greenpeace volunteers in Southern California, where Trader Joe's is based. And folks said, hey, Trader Joe's, you know, we love you as a store. We want to see you eliminate all these unnecessary plastic packaging of your products. And so Trader Joe's listened. So I think that's a good reminder, Melissa, that that customers and listeners, you really do have power here. And the next time you're in, say, your Publix or Harvey's or Winn-Dixie, ask to speak to the manager and let them know you want change. And so what we've been seeing, Melissa, is that some retailers, largely outside of the U.S., up in Canada and Quebec, Metro, which is a pretty large retailer, is starting to allow customers to bring in their own containers to the meat and seafood counters, to delis, to take hot to-go meals home. And so these are pretty simple fixes that we would love to see implemented by some of the largest grocers here in the U.S.
It's 549-2937. As we talk about fixes, we'll go to your calls in a moment. Here's an email, meanwhile, from Catherine. I am wondering, when I put the plastic bags in the recycle bins outside of Publix, do they actually get recycled? I think that's a question so many people have, David. Is the stuff we're putting in the recycling bin actually getting recycled, or is it ending up in a landfill or in that big, huge plastic glob of trash in the ocean?
Yeah, thank you for that question. We'd have to turn that to Publix, and one thing I would love is for Publix to be more transparent and let the public know, what's happening with those plastics and what are its larger initiatives to reduce its plastic footprint. I'll tell you that only 9%, again, of all plastics have ever been recycled, and even more have been incinerated, so 12%, and then the other 81% have either been landfilled or are ending up in our oceans, our waterways, and our environment. So it's unfortunate, Melissa. We know that recycling is part of the solution, but unfortunately, it's not been able to tackle this increased amount of plastic pollution in our environment. So that's why, again, we're saying we need to, if we think about it as a bathtub, right? If your bathtub was overflowing, you wouldn't turn off, you wouldn't get a mop and try to mop it up. You wouldn't want to turn it off at the tap. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're trying to do on plastics.
You're trying to get grocery stores to just create less plastic overall, which is a huge shift in their business model. It's not going to happen overnight, right? It takes public pressure and reports like yours, and as you said, the consumer's demanding it.
It does, and again, that example with Trader Joe's, these changes are possible, and so Trader Joe's still has a lot of work on its plate, but that is movement in the right direction. And the other thing I want listeners to know is that These, whether it's a Publix or Walmart, is the world's largest retailer. They have relationships with some very large consumer goods companies. So think Coca-Cola, Nestle, Unilever, PepsiCo. And so those are companies that are producing a lot of single-use plastics to package their products. So when a Publix or a Southeastern Grocers or Walmart or Target says to Nestle, you know, we're hearing these concerns from our customers. We want to ensure that our products are, we can still sell those products that folks need for their everyday lives, but we don't want them in single-use plastics anymore. You bet that the Nestles of the world are going to start to develop some of those innovative technologies to deliver products no longer packaged in single-use plastics.
If you're just tuning in, we're speaking with David Pinsky. He's the co-author of the new report, Packaging Away the Planet, ranking for the first time the nation's largest grocery chains on their efforts to eliminate single-use plastics. Lots of calls. Let's go to Don. He's at Kings Bay Naval Base. Hey, Don. Good morning. Go ahead.
Good morning. Yeah, I was just thinking that the most effective way to make the stores change their policies rather than shame them by giving them a bad report would really be to educate the consumer, because the consumer is the bottom line for every store. I mean, the dollar is their drive. So if we were to inform the consumer about the devastating effects of plastic as it decays in our system, the length of time it takes for that to decay, the addition of population as the population constantly grows, and the multiplication of this trash. I recall when I was a child, they had, you know, Smokey Bear ads that said don't light forest fires and also, you know, put trash in its place. I don't see messages like that at all anymore. And so, therefore, I think that people are just not informed. I see people throw McDonald's trash bags out of their window on the highway. And, you know, it just seems to me it's a lack of knowledge, a lack of understanding of what they're really doing. That's my comment. Thank you.
Okay, Don. Thanks for that. Yeah. I who can forget that commercial from when we were kids with the Native American crying as he saw people littering along the side of the road? So, David Pinsky, how much of this is on the consumer and how much of this is on the producers of the plastics?
Yeah, it's a great question. And Don, thanks for that comment and question. You know, there's certainly a role for us as consumers, but for the longest time, we've been told to be a good consumer, reduce, reuse, recycle. And when the petrochemical industry is planning to quadruple production of plastics over the next couple of decades, and again, I mentioned the equivalent of one truckload of plastic enters our oceans every minute, we know that this is a larger systemic problem. And so absolutely, Greenpeace is a part of it with education. We know that's a role here, and it's going to take some cultural change, but we need to work in concert with the large companies that have gotten us into this mess in the first place. And one thing we note in our report, as well as shopping for plastics, so I encourage folks to Google shopping for plastic Greenpeace. That's an interactive mobile-friendly ranking where you can learn more about your grocer and how you can take action. We absolutely know this is an education issue, and we want to invite folks to be part of this journey with us and together to encourage supermarkets to do the right thing.
Taylor is in Yulee. Hi, Taylor. How are you? Good morning.
Good, good. Thanks for having me on. I just wanted to make a comment about this kind of balance between producer and consumer. I study microplastics at Jacksonville University. I'm a master's student. One of the things that I've found in all of the research and things that I've done is that education on this is an issue, yes, but I think more importantly, the producers should be held more accountable. So in Germany, for instance, you can take all your plastic water bottles to a machine that will read the barcode on the bottle, and then the cost of recycling that is then put back on the producer. Because right now, the producers in our country do not have any liability for the amount of plastic they're producing and the amount of environmental destruction that that's causing. And I'll take the comments off the air. Thank you.
Okay. Taylor, thanks. And so different policies overseas than in America, David. Do we need policy change beyond just getting private business to change their ways and getting consumers to change their habits?
Absolutely, 100%. And Taylor, so thankful for your comment and for studying microplastics. we need to see extended producer responsibility, and that is something that Greenpeace has been supporting certainly overseas, and want to see that happen here as well. We have actually participated. We're a part of a global movement called Break Free from Plastic. It's well over 1,000 organizations. It keeps on growing in size, and we have actually conducted these brand audits in 42 countries around the world to identify which brands, say a Nestle, Coca-Cola, Unilever, are where we're finding their pollution in the environment. And some of the biggest names, as you could imagine, right? Coca-Cola and Nestle are coming up at the top of the list. So we're using that as a process to show the public that there is responsibility, that there is responsibility here, because they are polluting our environment. And here in Florida, I was very encouraged to see that your governor actually vetoed a preemptive ban of single-use plastic straw bans. So this is really not a partisan issue. Having clean drinking water, clean air and food is a basic human right. And so I think this is something where we can work across the aisle to ensure that there's stronger legislation in place.
There's a lot more about this at your website, greenpeace.org, because as plastics enter the food chain, enter the system, they pollute wildlife, marine life, and human beings. We have plastic chemicals in our bodies, right, David, because of the preponderance of single-use plastics everywhere.
Yes, so plastics are pervasive. Microplastics have been found in our drinking water, in our food, in our air, and marine life, as you mentioned. So this is becoming a public health crisis, and we don't fully understand all of the impacts here. So the research is still catching up, but we know the origins of plastics coming from fossil fuels. It can't be good for us, although a lot of that research is still out there and to be conducted. So again, at Greenpeace, we take a precautionary approach. We're hearing from the science that this is something we need to be concerned about. We don't want it to be in our food or in our drinking water or in our air. And so the best thing that we can do is again, address that growing production of plastics and try to change the tide and actually reduce how much plastics we're creating in the first place.
Melissa emails the show, hanging it all on groceries seems unfair. What about all those ridiculous plastic balloons sealed around small items like perfume, makeup? Sometimes they are several layers deep, an enormous amount of excess plastic. She's right in that plastic is packaged up on just about everything we buy. And so what's your final piece of advice for people listening to this discussion, what they can do?
So my final piece of advice is whether it's at your grocery store where you purchase food, if it's you're going to buy cosmetics, let folks at the store know that you don't want to see your products wrapped in single-use plastics, these plastics that are used for seconds or moments and last lifetimes. Your voice really matters, and I do encourage folks to check out Shopping for Plastic and Google that with Greenpeace. It'll pull it right up, and the next time you're in your grocery store, ask to speak to the manager, let them know your concern, and your voice is going to flow up to senior management at these companies and let them know that it's time that they take action.
David Pinsky co-authored Packaging Away the Planet. You can learn more at greenpeace.org. David, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much, Melissa.
And up next, a special treat as Duval's own Al Letson is back in town for a special performance. Find out more after this. We had a head back home in the suburb, over which I never could see. I heard the people who live on the ceiling screaming fire hysterically. Hearing that noise was my first ever feeling. That's how it's been all around me. I'm all lost in the
soup. Cypress Village, a continuing care retirement community, features apartments and homes surrounded by lakes and walking trails, minutes from the beach and adjacent to Mayo Clinic. 901-4222. More at lifecare.brookdale.com.
Out of the city of Jacksonville's resiliency committee say we should protect ourselves from sea level rise. The answer is on ADAPT from WJCT at adaptflorida.org.
The social platform Poshmark lets users buy and sell clothes, and it's become pretty popular. Collectively, its sellers have made over $1 billion.
Reselling, this sort of whole collaborative economy, is really mainstream. We take car sharing, we live in shared homes when we travel, and we buy and sell clothes.
I'm Kimberly Adams, a conversation with the CEO of Poshmark. That's next time on Marketplace.
This evening at 6, here on 89.9 WJCT.
Reports of immigrant children being held in squalid conditions at a Border Patrol station in Clint, Texas, have provoked public outrage and condemnation from federal judges. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Caitlin Dickerson, national immigration reporter for the New York Times, about the impact of the Trump administration's immigration policies. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
People of faith are on the front lines of the border crisis, sending volunteers and donations, but not all believers are on board.
She said, yes, but do we really want all those thousands and thousands of people? And I looked her in the eye and I said, this isn't about politics.
How are congregations dealing with disagreements over immigration policy? Next time on 1A.
Today at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, packaging powerful stories into a short period of time. The Short Attention Span Theater Festival is taking over the downtown Five and Dime Theater this weekend. And there's a special treat on the lineup. It's Al Letson, poet, playwright, and journalist. He'll be performing his show, and he joins us now in studio. Good morning.
Hey.
Good to have you on the show. Also with us, Evan Gould, founding member of the Five and Dime. Good
to
see you.
Nice to be here. Thank you.
And let's begin with you, Al. You're going to be the key attraction at the Short Attention Span Theater Festival at the Five and Dime. Welcome back to town, first of all. And
thank you.
Tell us about the performance. What are you going to be doing?
So it's a solo show. It's kind of like my niche in theater. I love doing solo performances. And this is a true story. That's about political violence in America. I try to look at political violence in America from a very personal point of view. But it's, hopefully it's the type of show that'll appeal to a lot of different people.
Right. It's called The Center Cannot Hold. And of course, you went from hosting State of the Reunion out of here, Jacksonville, Florida, to hosting another national show, Reveal, from the Center for Investigative Reporting. You're now based in California. And when you were out there working on the show, you covered a protest in Berkeley.
Yeah, I was covering a protest in Berkeley in 2017. This is like right after Charlottesville. And 2017 has been labeled by a lot of people as the summer of hate because there was a lot of these little incidences going on. And in the midst of covering this rally, I saw a man being jumped by about five or six Antifa members. And I ended up breaking up the fight by putting my body on top of him to stop them from hitting him. And it did. And afterwards, because I was working as a journalist, it's kind of a odd thing for a journalist to do. Me and my boss decided that, we have to, really investigate exactly what happened. So I interviewed all the people that were involved in that moment. And so that's what the show is about. It's interviewing. It's like looking at the conversations I had with those people, but also giving historical reference to how we got here and where we go forward.
And it's about racial hostility in America, our divisions.
Yeah, absolutely. It's about the fault lines. It's about, the things that, that are separating us in American life and how they, clash and grind together and how they've always done that. This isn't a new thing. We've been in this position since the founding of this country.
Why is it called The Center Cannot Hold? Do you feel like the country's coming apart?
I think that the country is always coming apart. I don't think it's new.
Because that's what your work really has always dealt with.
Right. I think that, so The Center Cannot Hold is a line from a Yeats poem called The Second Coming.
Yeah.
And that poem has stuck with me for many years. If you listen to State of the Reunion, at the end of State of the Reunion, I say, things fall apart, but we, the people, can bring them back together. That first line, things fall apart, is from The Center Cannot Hold. Mm-hmm. And I think when I was doing State of the Reunion, I was much more hopeful about where we are as a country. And I think now doing Reveal, a little less so. And so that the show references all of that.
So, Evan, people can come to the Short Attention Span Theater mm-hmm. Festival to see Al's show and a lot of other great shows,
yes.
too. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. Well, first of all, we are honored to have Jacksonville legend Al Letson as part of our festival. So they can come this Saturday starting at 10 a.m., going all the way until 8 o'clock. And there will be 9 productions ranging from comedies to dramas to one-man shows to original works by local artists. They can purchase a pass that will get them into all of the shows, or they can come to each individual show as well and pay admission when they get there.
So they can pick and choose their shows. There's a lot to choose from.
If they wish, yes. A pass obviously will get them the best deal and they can get to see everything.
And come downtown because the Five and Dime has this great space now mm-hmm. in downtown Jacksonville.
Right on Adams Street. Good parking too. Plenty of parking.
On a weekend, there's plenty to
Absolutely.
Go around. That's right.
Absolutely.
And so if you've never been to see live theater downtown, this weekend's your chance. Come see the Short Attention Span Theater Festival at the Five and Dime. Lots of great performances, including Al Letson's The Center Cannot Hold. Al, of course, is the host of Reveal, which we carry here on 89.9 and a First Coast native. He's in town for a short amount of time, so don't miss your chance to go see this production. Guys, thanks so much for being
pleasure.
With us. Break a leg and hope it's a great weekend of shows.
Yes, see you Saturday.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Thanks.
Thanks, everybody. And that's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Brady Corum is our director today. And if you have feedback, we always want to hear it. Send those emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. On tomorrow's show, join us for our Friday Media Roundtable. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. If you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, keep listening for the Electro Lounge. We'll see you tomorrow.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.